You're watching the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm, endorsed by the Hello Deli.
Yeah! La, 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 la. Welcome once again to the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm. I'm excited about today's guest because, in my opinion, he's the epitome of why this show exists. You know, we've had folks on the show as guests who, you know, have been affected in gigantic ways by working for, being part of, guesting on, you know, one of David Letterman's productions. And it's funny, you know, you think of people who have been there for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years plus. You think of the Jerry Mulligans of the world and people who were entrenched into that world. It was their world. Our episode with Matt Roberts, fantastic example of that last week, or a couple weeks ago, I guess now. And the cool thing about the ecosystem that was, you know, the production of David Letterman and company all those years, no matter which incarnation it was, you didn't have to work there very long or be a part of that very long to be affected by it. And that's something that I really do appreciate very much. The gentleman that we have on today has been in broadcasting now for decades and always wanted to be a broadcaster. He wanted to be a broadcaster because of David Letterman. Ended up going to New York from the South and going to New York, stranger in a strange land. This is a great story of about a stranger in a strange land in many, many respects. This gentleman's name is Tig Rogers. Now, Tig can be heard every day on 98.5 The Bull as part of the morning show, the Tig and Daniel show. It's also they were syndicated on iHeartRadio and but at the end of the day, you know, their show has evolved and changed. And they moved around with it. These guys have been broadcast partners for a long time and are extremely good at it. And you can actually hear him on Spotify and Apple. Their show is actually they've got a podcast out like many successful morning shows do. And just entertaining as all get out. And I just appreciate Tig's amazing skill as a broadcaster. Now, that started, though, as a desire when he was a youngster, and he was one of the lucky few that got a chance to go and become an intern at Late Show with David Letterman. And it affected his life to the point where it affects his life to this very, very day. And we had a fantastic conversation about some of the stories. I was saying to somebody who used to work for the show the other day, they said, "Oh yeah, who's the guest this week?" And I said, "His name's Tig Rogers. He was an intern. I remember him." He goes, "Oh, that's good. I'm glad you're having the interns on. The interns have the best stories." I loved hearing that because it's true. And it's you know, these people who spent a cup of coffee or two in the production, they have these amazing stories, and many of their lives have been affected just as much, if not more, than you know, people who stayed there for a long period of time. And it's fascinating listening to them. I think about Andy Carson a few weeks ago. You know, he's been a broadcaster for well over two decades because he got the bug, you know, working for late night. Tig is exactly 100% in that same camp. He has some great stories. He tells a story. This is true. Before we hit the record button, he had said something, and I brought up, I said, "Oh yeah, Sue Hum said something about that when she was on the show." And he goes, "Sue Hum? Let me tell you about Sue Hum. One time she had me dressed as a cat and I was going through the subway." And I'm like, "Stop talking right now. Stop talking. We're going to listen to that on the show. You're going to say this story on the show." And of course he tells the story in the show here. And it turns out when he was dressed as a cat on the subway, he was part of a legendary remote that happened on Late Show. And he was a part of it. And it's very, very cool. I've always wanted to talk. These are the people I've always wanted to talk to. You know, the person that's wearing the cat suit in this, who is that person? And what was it like for them? And, you know, what are some of the behind the scenes stuff? Tig is full of those things. This is an amazing episode that talks about following your passion. If you can find a way to monetize your passion or make your passion part of a career, what that means for you, fulfillment, all of that beautiful crap, and much, much, much more. The Letterman Podcast, obviously brought to you by the Hello Deli. Rupert still at this moment owns the deli. At the time of this recording, that's going to change soon. When it does change soon, we're going to announce it here. We're going to talk about the ins and outs and what's going to happen at that point. I just appreciate every single person that has given us some time with their ear holes or time with their eyeballs or both. Thank you very much for catching the spirit of what it is that we want to do here. I would do this show if we had no audience, but it turns out there are people who are actually digging what we're doing. So thank you for that. For those who are frustrated, I want this show so bad. I just want it to be better than it is. We're working on it. We're trying to get there. Okay. Thank you very much. Enjoy this episode of the Letterman Podcast featuring 98.5 The Bulls' own Tig Rogers. Okay, Tig, first thing I got to ask you, because, you know, you and Daniel do the show, 98.5 The Bull, Tulsa, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
We are.
Tig, to me, is very, very much an on-the-nose name for a morning DJ. Is that your given name? Is Tig the you know, what's on your driver's license?
You know, early in my career, they said, you got to change your name, but that's the name I was given. And they wanted me to go by like Tadpole or Turtle or some bullcrap. And, I said, you know, I'm not going to do that. I got to go to ribbon cuttings and stuff to, you know, be in the community as a broadcaster. And so I fought that little fight, but it's worked out for me because Tig is such a unique name that once you hear it, you don't meet other Tigs and say, oh, that must be the guy who's on the radio. So it's actually kind of worked out for me.
Absolutely. It's a perfect broadcaster name. I love it so much. I've been listening to, in preparation for this, just to hear, you and Daniel every day, your morning show is put on, you got a podcast. It's on the Apple and the Spotify's and all of that stuff. The Tig and Daniel show. That's a lot of fun. How long you been doing it now for the Bull?
My buddy and I, Daniel, have been doing the show for about 20 years. We were syndicated for many, many years with iHeartRadio, and then that went away during the pandemic. And so we found a job in Tulsa. And I'm glad to be working in broadcasting because it's a little tough out there right now and TV and radio. So, you know, I'm glad to be doing something that I love. I set out when I was watching the Letterman show, I would see Dave, and to me, he's a broadcaster, not a comedian. He's a broadcaster that tells jokes, and I just fell in love with the show like so many other people. It's nothing unique. You got Jimmy Kimmel, who was influenced by him, Conan O'Brien, and I was no different. Now, they've had meteoric careers, but I'm glad to be making a decent living, so.
You know, it's funny, though. The early adopters of this show, a lot of them, in the TV or the radio business somewhere, in broadcasting, you know, like different cameramen or booth operators, controllers, sound techs, you know, even on screen or over the microphone talent. A lot of people in broadcasting are, you know, were attracted by Dave's magnet of that. I think that's a really, really good point. So early on, you were influenced by Dave, like growing up, like so many of us, like you said. It was your dream to get, you kind of did that thing. You grew up in that area, like in the area that you're in right now. And then you made the trek to New York just to, you know, kind of like the Sinatra song, if I can make it there, I make it anywhere. Is that basically your story as to how you became an intern at Late Show?
It was an accident, really. I grew up in Alabama. And so to see this show from New York City every night, I mean, it just made it magical. And what I didn't realize is the hard work that went into it, which is a testament to David Letterman. He made it look like it was just easy, right? But there's all these people that work on the show and day after day after day, and you get done with Monday show and you're working on Tuesday show and then Wednesday show. It's just on and on and on. Yep. And I needed to have an internship to graduate from college at Auburn University, War Eagle, by the way. And and I thought that I would just intern at the local TV station. And that's kind of what I thought. But I remember seeing Dave talk to interns, or at least talk about interns. And I got on the CBS website. And that very day, it said the deadline was that very day. And so I wrote up a resume. And then they said, why would you be a good intern? And I had what turned out to be not a genius idea, but in my head, it was top 10 reasons I would be a good intern. But then I scrapped that immediately because I thought that's probably what everybody's writing about. I'm not going to stand out if I do that. And so I wrote about, I actually want to be a broadcaster. I want to learn. The Letterman show for me would be a learning lab. And the next day, Janice Panino, who was in charge of HR there, called me and said, would you fly up for an interview? And then the rest is history. And so I didn't send the top 10 list. And one of my jobs there was opening the mail for Dave. And you had to read everything that came in, because if somebody wrote a 14-page letter, you had to read the whole thing in case there was like a threat in it.
Right.
So you couldn't just throw it away.
Yep.
And man, the interns that applied, they all wrote top 10 lists. So it was almost, you weren't unique suddenly. And so I'm glad I made that decision not to send in top 10 reasons I would be a good intern. So
oh my God, that's
it worked
so
out.
Oh, that gives me goosebumps right there, that you had that instinct to go with earnestness and to go not just with earnestness, but the idea of wanting to further yourself to get into broadcasting. It was so, I love that. I'm trying to get Janice on here. I think I've got her convinced to come on here, because the stories that gal has, being in HR there, but a lot of folks have expressed sentiments about her and,
She changed my life. I mean, she gave me a shot when, I really probably, she could have chose other people. But she gave me a shot and I'm forever grateful for that. I think it helped me in my career, just being able to put on the resume, Late Show with David Letterman. That at least got a conversation started with people, which is, you know, breaking the ice, and it was perfect for me. And I appreciate everything she did for me and the Letterman show.
So how old were you at the time when you got that call?
I was probably 21 years old, in college, needed an internship. Like I said, I thought I was just going to intern at the local TV station. And by the way, I got to point out that the people at the local TV station, they have these huge egos. They're in Montgomery, Alabama, and they're like, I'm the news director in Montgomery. Meanwhile, I got to the Letterman show, and people couldn't have been nicer. Like, they didn't have this huge ego, at least the people that I was around.
Yep.
And so I was shocked, because the people in Montgomery, Alabama thought that they were like on top of the world, and I get to, you know, an actual show on network television, and people just couldn't have been nicer. I mean, Biff Henderson knew my dad's name, Rupert G knew I was from Alabama, and they would ask me like, how's the, it was just great. I couldn't believe it.
So, okay. You're a 21 year old kid. You're in Alabama. The magic of, I'm Western Canada here. I understand entirely what you're talking about. The magic that is out in New York, you know, the greatest city in the world, as Alan Coulter would call it. And it just had this feeling that radiated from it. You're feeling that down there. You get the call that you're not going to be local. You're going to be going to New York City. How much did that upset the apple cart of the family and all of that stuff, going, okay, how are we going to pay for this? How are we going to make this happen? Was it seamless, or was there some hoops that had to be jumped through?
Well, I was very fortunate. My sister already lived in the city, and so I was able to couch it the whole time. So, I mean, it just worked out for me. But I got to tell you that in small town Alabama, when they heard you're going to New York City to work for David Letterman, like the local school newspaper wanted to interview me. I mean, this was as if I was going to host the show. Yeah. It was a big deal for a lot of people. And, I became, in a sense, like a tiny celebrity just based on me opening mail at the Letterman show. So it was a roller coaster, and I loved every second of it. And I appreciate the people that gave me the opportunity to build my broadcasting career. And I think that helped a lot. And so I owe a lot to the Letterman show and the people there that were very kind to me the whole way through.
Yeah. And I mean, this sentiment of people who have also gone into broadcasting, regional broadcasting, all over the continent, who once had a brush with the show, either as an intern or maybe, even a page, things like that. People who have done that, there, a lot of folks have done that. And they talk about, even if they were there for a cup of coffee or two, how much they actually learned and the things that the way that the experience hit them. I love that you're starting with this, man. How long were you in New York to kind of get a feel for the place before your first day?
I flew up there October 15th, which was right after 9/11. So 9/11, happened in September. I was there October 15th for my first interview with the Letterman show. And then I permanently moved up there January 7. So it was several months after the attacks on America. And it was a wild time. And, I got to say that I think that maybe I wasn't selected as an intern, but I think that the people that were, some of them backed off after that. And I kind of filled a void that maybe somebody had decided, you know, I don't know if this is for me to go to New York, but I was raring to go. And when Janice Panino told me that I was selected, I said, I will be there. I had no idea how I was going to pay for the flight, but I said, yep, I will be there. And my dad, I was lucky enough to have parents that helped me out, and then a sister that lived in the city. And it was just great. It just all worked out for me.
What part of the city did she live in?
She lived in a place called Stuyvesant Town, which is in Manhattan. And so it took me about 20 minutes on the subway to get to work every day. And it was just great.
Yep, that's not bad. Okay, so you get the feel of the place. Talk to me a little bit about the stranger and a stranger. Had you been to New York before, like to visit her or anything like that? Or was this your, like, literally, you know, like out of a, I don't know what kind of a movie where you're showing up with your, you know, from the South with your couple of suitcases Hodunk, Alabama, around the big city. Like,
well, since my sister lived there, I had visited, but really, I feel bad about saying this, but I would go to see my sister, but really I was there to go to the Letterman show. And I went to several tapings of the Letterman show.
Yep.
I was there in 96, to a Letterman show, and I wore a suit to the show. And, you have to be 16 to get in. And I had just turned 16, but I always looked about 12. And so they were like, really like asking me, like, are you sure you're 16? They wanted to make sure that I was of age. And I wore a suit to the show. I don't know what I was doing. I wore a suit, and David Letterman caught a glimpse of the suit, and he never said anything, but I could kind of tell he noticed there's like some 12-year-old with a suit on in the audience. So, so I was a big Dave fan, and to get to intern there later, you know, 5 years later, was just, you know, knock your socks off kind of stuff.
How many tapings did you go to?
I went to two tapings before I became an intern.
Yep.
And then as an intern, half of my day was in the mailroom, which, by the way, I want to tell people, if you get assigned to the mailroom, that's a great place to be. It doesn't sound as sexy as, I had interns that I worked with that were in the writer's room.
Yep.
And some interns that were in Dave's office. Yep. And there was a little bit of like, man, I wish I was. But the mailroom intern gets to go everywhere in the building, unlike the other interns. You got to stay on your floor. So I met everybody. I met Sheila Rogers. I hung out with Paul Schaefer. I hung out in Dave's office, you know, his assistants. You get to know everybody. And I just thought it was great. You know, at first I was like, oh, I'm the mailroom intern, so I'm like the bottom of the barrel intern. But I worked with a guy named Tom Foster, who was a mailroom guy, and he eventually made it to the writer's floor as a writer's assistant or a writer's researcher. And he was just great to me. So I really, like, if you get an internship and they put you in the mailroom, that's a good internship, because you're going to meet everybody when other people don't get to meet everybody.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Okay, so I want to get into the meat and potatoes of the actual internship and all of that here in a second. But do you remember the tapings that you went to? Do you remember, were there any memorable moments from those tapings that happened on the show?
Okay, so what happened to me was, I was so excited to be in New York City and at the David Letterman show.
Yep.
And Independence Day, remember the one, the big blockbuster in the 90s, absolutely. Independence Day? That had just come out, so a lot of the monologue was about that. And I got to be in the audience, and Dave, before the show, does a question and answer period. Mm-hmm. He comes out, and he's like, oh, you know, where is everybody from, and whatever. And you hold up your hand.
Yep.
And then he will choose you if you're lucky. But I decided not to take my chances. I just started yelling at him. And I was like, Dave,
doing exactly what the pages tell you not to do.
Yeah, they had gone exactly. They had gone over these instructions. Don't like it. Don't act like an idiot in there. Don't do anything crazy or we'll kick you out of the studio. Well, what I did immediately was act like an idiot. And I said, Dave. And Dave looks at me. This is before I was interning. I was just a fan.
Yep.
And he says, yes, the hyperactive young man over there. What's your question?
Oh, how good does that feel to even be able to say that as a Letterman fan, to him to, you know, to give you that little bit of a, you know, isn't that the greatest? That's fantastic.
It was wild that I had David Letterman's attention.
Yes.
You know, for a moment. I'd seen him on television. And then suddenly this guy's looking right at me. I can see his eyes. He's just concentrating on me. And I asked whatever question it was. It had something to do with my eventual alma mater playing Ball State in a football game. Yeah. And I said, I go to Auburn University. He said, that's not my problem, son. And then cut me off. And then a guy named David Kay, who I later got to know, he's in charge of the audience.
Yep.
He came over and just let me have it. He said, I will kick you out of here. Don't make another move during the show. I'll kick you out of here. And then later on, I got to know David Kay a little bit. So it was kind of.
Did you tell him that story?
Yeah, I told him that story. I said, dude, you almost kicked me out about 4 years ago when I was 16.
Oh, that's hilarious. I can't wait to send him that clip of this show. He's been on the show here and we're going to have him on again. So that's going to be a lot of fun to
He'll have no recollection of this, but it was a true story that he came up to me in the audience and said, we're about to kick you out, buddy. And then I got very quiet and I watched the shows.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's not my problem. Oh, that's lovely. And so the Independence Day, okay, that was the first time you went?
I was 16 years old, and then I went a couple times later on in my later teens, and then eventually I ended up there and was able to see almost every show.
Thank you so much, Sis. Thank you so much for being in New York to give you that that experience. Man, fantastic. Okay, so I want to go back to your first day. So do you remember the first day? Do you remember going in, getting your pass, all of that stuff? I mean, I can imagine that's sort of seared in your mind.
Yeah, I remember that very well. They put us all in a room. There's probably 12 interns, and they go over the ground rules. And it's, you know, a lot of people hear about Hollywood and you're not supposed to talk to the actors and stuff. But I kind of got it, because if Tom Cruise is in the green room and 300 people come up to him and bother him while he's trying to get ready, that's a problem. And so it was kind of stuff like, hey, man, make sure you don't talk to the actors unless they talk to you. That's fine. Mr. Letterman is a busy guy. Don't go in there and ask him about his weekend. But it made sense to me, because he's got 200 employees. If everybody went up there and talked about what they did on Sunday, that would be a problem for a guy who's also running Worldwide Pants and trying to conduct a television show.
Yep.
So I remember that specifically. I'm not going to talk to David Letterman unless he speaks to me. And it wasn't an ego thing. It was just everybody who works knows that when somebody comes in your office, it's a distraction from what you're trying to accomplish that day. Doesn't matter if you're an accountant or whatever. So I got it. And but as my mailroom duties, which was the first half of my day, I would see Mr. Letterman, as I called him. And, you know, it's like a quick hi in the hallway and that kind of stuff. But I left him alone. So yeah. I followed the instructions. I understood the assignment.
I love you're not the first person that has come on here and expressed the sentiment that, okay, you know, people got it wrong. It's not that don't make eye contact with him. Don't, like, that's not what it's about. It's not about him being, you know, egoic or whatever. It's a crazy busy environment. And I mean, with many gears and moving parts that need to intersect with each other at certain times, because 5:30 is coming and all sorts of stuff that needs to get done. It's a matter of necessity, not a matter of ego. And I love when people make that distinction. Okay. So first day, you were assigned to the mailroom on that day. Is it like, I mean, there's the orientation, I assume. Do you remember
any of the interns
that were there at the time? Did any of them end up staying with the show?
There are several people that I work with that are much more successful than I was past our internship. I got a friend named Rima. She went on to be a booker for The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon.
Wow.
Dana Moreno, who went to work for NBC Universal. I'm kind of the black sheep, I guess. But,
you know, what are you talking about?
I went into it to get into broadcasting. But there's a lot of people who interned there that wanted to get in television, not necessarily the broadcasting part, but the business part.
Yeah.
And they did quite well with their careers. And I think they owe a lot of that to the Letterman show. And so as much as we watched the show and thought it was fun, Dave in the background was also helping people with their careers, getting great experience. And they went on to do big things. But I worked in the mailroom for the first half of the day. And then I went down to the music room for the second half of the day. And I worked with a guy named Harvey Goldberg, who worked with the Rolling Stones, and he would tell me stories about Mick Jagger and things. And so he's still at the Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He's the guy that every time a band's on, he mixes the music for the show.
Yep.
And so that was great. I mean, I loved it. I didn't really have much of a role down there. They're not going to let an intern operate equipment that's going to be on national television. However, I did assist however I could, which... they were just very sweet to me and let me think I was doing something important, but really all I was doing was nothing.
Just obviously, there's a lot of music in your life now. Were you a music guy growing up? Like, was that something where you got stoked about it because, oh my God, I get to do this? Or was that, did it just sort of evolve into that?
No, I'm not a music guy, and people think that people who are on the radio are. I'm a broadcast fan, and David Letterman is the one that kind of. So the music isn't as important to me as I like doing content, and I like trying to entertain an audience. And to me, that's that I got the bug from David Letterman, to be honest. And you know, I owe him a lot of my career, to be honest, because I don't think I'd have been doing this. And I've had a nice career and a fun career. And when I saw him do it, I thought, man, maybe I could do this, because everybody I saw on television before that was like, you know, Larry Hagman and all these good looking dudes. And I'm
That's
like, hey, there's a guy that's just
Larry
like
Hagman,
me.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Tom Selleck was, you know, had the show, and, you know, and then wait, there's a guy who's just being himself. And I go, man, if I can make a living at that, wow, that is slick.
That is, that's so great, because, you know, I don't know if I should say this out loud or not. We're going to have a legendary broadcaster come on, somebody who Dave, you know, wrote a letter to before he, you know, when he was still in Indianapolis. I just love how Dave was inspired by other broadcasters, and then that moved on to people in our generation. And people change their lives because of that. I never had that moment. But, you know, I'm a financial advisor by trade, and I always knew that was in me too, because of Dave and because of other broadcasters that I admired very, very much. I'm Canada, Ron McLean up here in Canada, and different broadcasters around the world. But I didn't grow up in a place where I was, you know, encouraged to go chase that dream. But it was always there. And then when podcasting showed up and kind of everything kind of opened up, I can completely identify with what you're talking about, because when you're doing this, just being yourself conversationally, or if you're trying to be witty or trying to throw some stuff out there, be entertaining. I the only way I can describe it is like a musician being in the zone. You know, if they're doing a solo of some sort or whatever, and they're being in the zone, that's kind of what it feels like. It's magical, isn't it?
It's fantastic. And, you know, I've learned a lot along the way, and I think David Letterman had picked this up, but if you're just yourself, man, it's better than faking it. And that's what I always thought about David Letterman, is that you could almost tell when he was having a night where he didn't want to talk to the guest.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, Jimmy Kimmel once said on, by the way, Walter Kim does a fantastic job with the Letterman YouTube channel.
He sure does.
And he got Kimmel on there, and Kimmel said the guy acted like he was embarrassed to be there half the time. Like,
yeah.
You know, like he was just being real the whole time. And I go, you can make a living at this? This is crazy. And that's what I've tried to emulate.
Well, and you and Daniel, like, I mean, you know, just to move aside from your time at the Ed Sullivan Theater for a minute, you and Daniel have this repartee that is just dynamite. It is so good. Like on a previous episode that I listened to, I just listened to the one where you guys were talking about the movies, Barbie and Oppenheimer and all that. That was really good. There's a previous episode though, where you made me laugh out loud. You talked about when you were breaking into his house and he came home and found that his sliders were gone. And you said, well, I was a guest in your house. And just like the way that, and I'm butchering it, but the way that you guys just went back and forth with the rat-a-tat, it was so seamless and perfect, yet at the same time, off the cuff, you were both being yourselves. But I got to ask, because I don't imagine that you have done this partnership this whole time as you've been in broadcasting. Do you enjoy doing the solo act, or do you enjoy having somebody there with you 50-50?
Oh, no, I love having somebody there, because I think there's comedy and conflict, you know. And I think, you know, if you watch the old Letterman clips, sometimes Dave and Paul, they kind of had this thing going on. And I remember Paul, maybe I was there, maybe I just saw on television, would cuss Dave out. And I just couldn't, like, this was like the greatest, like seeing a boss get cussed out. Like, yeah. Doesn't everybody have that kind of, like, everybody sort of wants to cuss out their boss. Yeah. And, you know, Paul's on the air cussing Dave out and storming off the stage. And so I do like the back and forth for sure. I mean, it helps. And when Daniel's sick or something, the show totally sucks. And I don't have that, you know, other partner to kind of bounce off of. So yeah, it works. And I think, you know, Dave was much more then you know, Paul was part of that process, but you know, it was fun to see them interact sometimes where maybe they didn't get along, maybe they were getting along, but I just love that part of it. So it's always easier. It's like Seinfeld and Kramer. Is Seinfeld successful without Kramer acting like a crazy person?
Yep.
I don't know. You know, so I enjoy that part of it. Yeah.
You need something to play off of.
I think so.
Kind of light it up. Yeah. I want to go back to when you were working with Harvey for a second here. So the second half of the day, so you do your mailroom duties, and then you end up going to work with Harvey. Is that during the rehearsal for the musical act?
Yes. And working with him? Yeah. So I would go down there during the rehearsal, the bands would come in. And the thing about the Ed Sullivan Theater is it's not the most advanced soundstage there has ever been. You know, like Jay Leno did his in a soundstage in Burbank, but this was an actual theater that was retrofitted for television. And so a lot of times the acts, I'll just throw out an example, Willie Nelson or something, they would go rehearse and then they'd want to come down to the music room to listen to it to see how the acoustics sounded. And so a lot of times I would be down there watching rehearsal and then the acts would come down and listen to the playback to see if they needed to change anything about their performance. And so that was fun. And I got to meet, you know, or at least look at people. Again, they told us not to talk to the celebrity. So I would just look at Bonnie Raitt, who was 3 feet from me. But, you know, it was a great time. And Harvey Goldberg was completely nice to me. I want to reiterate this, that the people in Montgomery, Alabama, all kind of jackasses. When you get to New York, it's kind of funny. They were so nice to me. It was almost uncomfortable how nice they were, you know, to an intern that meant nothing to them. 21-year-old kid, and they've got this great career going, but they were so sweet. I was touched the whole time I was there by their generosity and kindness to me.
Okay, so you mentioned Bonnie Raitt, Willie Nelson. Okay, let's go through a bit of a list of people that you saw 3 feet in front of you that you dared not talk to. Who were some of the folks that were memorable that came down there?
Well, if you want a not music related one, I've got one for you if you'd like.
Sure. I'll take whatever you got.
So at the Late Show with David Letterman, they had what I'll call Green Room A. Green Room is where they put the celebrities, right?
Yep.
And then there was Green Room B, that was like the lesser green room of the two. And Green Room B happened to just be where I was in the music room right next door.
Yep.
And so let's just say Tom Hanks was on the show. He's in Green Room A.
Yep.
But if they had an Olympic gold medalist, that's Green Room B guy.
Yep.
So there they are. One night, Buzz Aldrin came on the show. And I can't remember who the main guest was, but it was somebody super famous, John Travolta or somebody. But they put Buzz Aldrin in the Green Room B. And I'm looking over at Buzz Aldrin, second guy on the moon, and going, I know I'm not supposed to talk to him. However, it is Buzz Aldrin. Am I willing to risk it? And so as an intern, I pretended like I needed to change the trash out. And so I walked into the Green Room B, as I call it, and I pretended like it was full and grabbed the liner. And I watched Buzz Aldrin eat a chocolate chip cookie. And that's my claim to fame at the Late Show with David Letterman.
And didn't say a word to him.
I don't think if there was, it was just a, hey, I didn't talk to him about the moon. I just was like, hey, how you doing? And I said, man, I just saw Buzz Aldrin eat a chocolate chip cookie. So, you know, who's ever done that?
Oh, those, God, when they would send him out in the astronaut suit to award ceremonies and things like that, that is some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen.
Yeah, he would, and when I met him, he was dressed in an astronaut outfit because he was doing a bit for the show. So I met Buzz Aldrin dressed as an astronaut. But I remember he would go out and go to the red carpet, Buzz Aldrin would, and he would ask them a question and say, like, oh, what's it like to win an Emmy or something? They say, it's great. And he'd go, I went to the moon. He'd try to one up him. That's all he would say. I went to the moon. Like, you got an Emmy, but I went to the moon. So it was a great time with meeting him, even though I was changing the trash, but at least I got to see him.
Yeah. Oh, this is good stuff. Some of the other people that you got to see, you know, you got to see Biff. You talk about that. You got to see Pat Farmer. You got to see Kenny. You got to see some of these people that you watched on TV for so long. And then you had the experience of how nice they all were. it must have felt, but at the same time, not getting paid, you know, and learning these things, it's like lots of good stuff, but then at the same time, also knowing it's kind of temporary, you know, it must have been surreal for you. It must have been a surreal time.
It was stunning. I remember one time that we had a what they call in television a dark week, which meant that we weren't doing shows that week, but we still came to work. And I remember walking down to the stage where the show was done on the ground level. And I remember seeing David Letterman didn't have a star. You know, like a lot of people, when they do their monologue, they look for this little mark to stand on so the cameras are good. He had a circle. And I went out there and just stood on that circle and just looked out there and said, this is where it all is. You know, it was crazy. But to your point about how nice people were, I developed a friendship with Tony Mendez, who it was the cue card guy. And he was just, he was so funny to me because he was the only guy in the building that could tell David Letterman to fuck off.
Yeah.
They had this relationship. And I love the disparity of the host of this network television and the cue card guy telling him to get lost.
Yep.
You know, and yelling at him and complaining with him. And I just love that. And Tony Mendez, who we just lost recently, was very kind to me. And he did a show called The Tony Mendez Show.
Yes.
Which was an internet show that they recorded after Dave got off the air. And usually Dave had slipped into his jogging pants by then and a t-shirt. And Tony Mendez said, Tig, if you ever have any ideas for this show, let me know, because I'm doing five of these a week and, you know, it's getting kind of. And so I had an idea where it's so stupid, but they used to send flowers to the show all the time. I don't know why. They've got flowers all the time. And it might have been because, you know, a guest came on the show and they were sending them flowers or whatever. Yep. But there was just flowers everywhere, it seemed like to me. And I said, Tony, one night on the Tony Mendez show, why don't you act like you're thirsty, remove the flowers from a vase and just drink it in front of Dave? And he's like, I'm going to do that tonight. And he did it. And the next day I saw the Tony Mendez show and Dave laughed his ass off. So I was like, you know, I finally made it, man. I made David Letterman laugh. And so, yeah, people are just completely nice. Pat Farmer, Biff Henderson, Sue Hum, who you've had on the show before, I think.
Yep.
I just couldn't believe how nice people were to me. Because you grew up in Alabama and you get this idea that if you fall down on the street in New York City, no one will help you. I found that to be the opposite.
Yes.
And it was a great time in my life. And I'm so appreciative of it.
You mentioned Sue Hum before we hit the record button. I said something about it just offhand. Yeah, like when we had Sue Hum on the show. And I'm just going to say it from there. Well, how did you respond to that? And what's the story? We had Sue Hum on the show before.
Yeah, Sue Hum, she was, to let people know, I for lack of a better way to, she was kind of in charge of the dressing Dave. And then also if there were bits on the show, she would come up with the costumes and that kind of stuff. And one, you might remember this period where Dave would just try to put as many people in a store as he could. So it was something like, let's see how many people in Batman costumes we can get in the Starbucks before they call the cops. And when I was there, Spider-Man was hot. With Tobey Maguire. And so that was the big thing. And so it became, how many dudes in Spider-Man costumes can we fit into a Subway restaurant? But the joke was, after like 13 people, they ran out of Spider-Man costumes.
Yeah.
So they put me in a pink cat uniform. And Sue Hum did that. And I said, you know, is this for real? And they're putting makeup on me to make me, because I was supposed to be from the cast of Cats, I guess. And they put us in the Subway restaurant, and eventually cops came and they told us to get lost. And I remember this lady came up to me when I was walking back to the Ed Sullivan Theater from the Subway. She goes, sir, why are you dressed as a cat? I said, well, I was just on the David Letterman show. And she goes, yeah, right. But I really had been. I guess she thought I was just a crazy person dressed as a pink cat. But it was Sue Hum did all that. She did a fantastic job with all that stuff all the time.
That's an iconic moment. Like, you were part of an iconic moment on Late Show. You know, I think Walter's put up a couple of them. I know he did the one at Tax Time and all of that. I think he might have put the Spider-Man one up when one of the Spider-Man movies recently came out. I think that might be on the official channel. But that's an iconic moment you got to be a part of. It's great that I get to ask you about this. This is why we do this show right here. You know, the shorthand when I was kind of developing the show was sometimes people, you know, David Letterman would call a payphone from his desk on late night or show, right? And then somebody answered the payphone, and you know, I had my little brush with the show. And one time I had a conversation online with a guy who picked up the payphone, and he told me this story about how, you know, he got his, Dave didn't want to talk to him. He talked to his wife instead and all this sort of stuff. And we talked about this for about 20 minutes, and 25 years later, he's still telling the story like it happened yesterday. And I thought, okay, this is why we have to do this show here. You were one of the people in one of the costumes. And so I got to pick your brain about this moment for a second, because it is iconic from the lore of Letterman. As it's happening, the audience sees Dave reacting what seems to be real time. Okay, send in another one, send in another one. He's not just reacting to videotape. This is happening real time, right?
Yeah, I couldn't hear what David Letterman was saying. They had people out there that would kind of signal us.
Yes.
Okay, now we need three more of you to walk in. Okay, two more this time, one more this time. And Eddie Balk, who was on the stage there, he was the only guy who had an earpiece as far as I remember. Yep. So when we got in the subway, he was kind of the conductor of the operation.
Yep.
Because he was hearing the show. And Dave would say, hey, make sure that one Spider-Man moves over so we can see what's going on in the background, see if the subway employees are irritated or not. So Eddie Valk was the one saying, hey, man, you need to move over. But he's the only one that heard anything that's going on. But it was in real time.
Yeah,
it was happening during the show. The show taped at 5:30 that day. And we were out there at 5:50 for that break and doing the bit. So it was in real time. And the show ended in real time at 6:30. So had it been a disaster, it would have been, you know, had it not worked, it just would have been on television that night. But it worked, you know.
That must have been, you talk about the moment where you stood on Dave's marker and looked around. That's another one of those. It has to be one of those moments where you're a part of Dave's tomfoolery, and you're a cast member of some of the zaniness that Dave would unleash on the city of New York to entertain people around the world. You were a part of that. And you were an intern there. You weren't even a paid staff member, and you were part of that. That's got to live in your heart still.
Oh, it's one of the best experiences of my professional life. And I'll tell you that the first time that I walked out on that stage as an intern, it's like what you've seen since you were a little boy.
Yeah.
And you see it in person, and you're looking at the chair, and you're looking at Paul Schaefer's piano. And you just can't damn believe it. And I just could not believe that I was there. And it was I had to pretend like I wasn't that excited, because if you pretended overexcited, they kind of thought you were a fanboy. And so even though I was a fanboy, I had to pretend like it wasn't that cool to me, because they, you know, the people there, that's their careers, and they don't want interns there that are just jokesters. They want people that are going to help them in their career and be useful. And so I had to mask it a lot of times, where, you know, I was in a bit one time, and a guy named Tom Ruprecht wrote a bit, and I ruined the bit for him because it never made it to the show.
And, no kidding.
Tom Ruprecht, it was one of the nicest dudes in the world.
He's been on the show as well.
Yeah, he's wonderful. And he wrote this was Spider-Man era, and he wrote a skit for the CBS mailbag that was, Dave, how do you get people to come to your show? And he said, I'll show you. And the bit was that they had changed the marquee outside. Instead of saying Late Show with David Letterman, they put up, this is Spider-Man movie. So people came in thinking it was Spider-Man, and that's how they tricked people to come into the show. And I was the one guy who said, how come outside it says Spider-Man, but it looks like it's the Late Show with David Letterman? And he goes, don't worry, it's Spider-Man, just go sit down. But I suck at acting. I'm like the worst. And and I apologized to Tommy Ruprecht after that. I said, man, because Dave would watch the skits, you know, in his office and decide which made it and which didn't, and mine got cut. And I apologized to Tom. I was like, man, I think I blew that because I sucked at acting. And so you know, that never made it. I'm sure it's somewhere on tape. I haven't seen it in 20 years, but you know, you call your parents, you're like, I think I'm going to be on the show tonight, and then it doesn't make the cut.
There's a lot of that. And it's funny, you know, just to kind of PS that though for a second, when Tommy was on the show, I actually asked him are there things that ended up on the cutting room floor that you remember that you wish would have got on? And it's so funny. His response was, you know, it's the only stuff that I remember that didn't get on was at the very, very, very beginning of when I showed up as a writer. Because after that, you just immediately learn the skill that some things make it and some things don't. But you got to keep going because, like you said, there's another show tomorrow. There's another show. We got to just keep rolling with it. So he goes, I'm sure, you know, and I might be combining him with one of the other writers as well. But the sentiment was, I'm certain that there is lots of stuff that was on the cutting room floor, you know, but I don't have any attachment to it. Which I thought was that was really, really insightful. I don't know how, I don't know who's got them. If it's Walter, I know Rick Sheckman, who just recently passed, had a lot of stuff that was cut or never aired. Jay Johnson probably has some, I would think, although he's working for Seth now. But I mean, I keep trying to bug them as, you know, respectfully as I can. I think that there's a lot of gold. I'm the guy who, when I buy a DVD, I'll go watch the commentary first or the deleted scenes first. I just love that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there's probably a lot of gold in there, you know, in the vaults. And it would be really, really cool to curate some of that stuff and release some of it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there is. I mean, I used to see on the monitors where they were doing bits, and then you would never see it on the show. I mean, I specifically remember one time there was a bit with a cab that cost $2,000 an hour because you have to have a TV cab.
Yeah.
You can't just have a cab. It's got to be like no license plate and whatever. And it sat out there and it's like $2,000 an hour. And then it didn't make it to the show. So there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, never made it on the show.
Just as a guilty pleasure for me personally, I wonder about all of the Alan Coulter stuff that didn't make the show. I loved Alan Coulter so much. Like, I love the stuff they got him to do. He executed it flawlessly, and just, you know, had no problem to make himself look like a buffoon in any arena. And he was just so, so good. I just imagine how much Alan Coulter stuff is sitting in this vault and how much fun it would be to get some of these things out. Any other bits that you were a part of back in the day?
I did some stuff and where I would just be kind of an extra and an audience at a football game. So nothing of note, but you know, it was fun to be able to call home and say, "Hey, watch the show tonight, Dad. I think I might be on." And then it might not make the cut. Then you're like, "Oh, well, maybe next time. I don't know." But it was certainly fun. And Alan Coulter was he was a genius. He played that role. So, and it was another episode or example to me of a subordinate talking to the boss the way that he did. And I think people love that, you know, for him to talk. He said he looked like a duck face and called him an SOB all the time on the air. It was just so fun to see Alan Coulter. And later on in my career, when I got one of my first radio shows, Alan Coulter did what we call liners, but basically he would say, he cut these for me and said, "This is Alan Coulter and you're listening to Tige and Daniel." And he didn't have to do that. I mean, he's a professional voice actor that got, and he would just do that kind of stuff for us. And so he was a wonderful person. And I thought he just, his deadpan delivery and talking truth to power today, you know, even if it was just silliness, it was just so fun to see how Alan Coulter really played that role really, really well.
Absolutely. He was a gem. Another reason that, you know, the thing that pulled the trigger on this show was his passing. And I had already become, you know, sort of friends with Shecky, and he and I would go back and forth and have conversations. And from everything I've heard from everybody, but Shecky was the first person to say this. And he said, "Oh, it's such a shame that Alan," he goes, "and by the way, if you ever do this show, you know, Alan is the type of guy that would be on every other week if you wanted him." He's so kind and so giving, and he just loved participating in things and had no ego whatsoever. That is
no,
really
I
cool
remember
that Alan did that for you. Do you still have them, like the MP3 of that, or the, do you have the?
Yeah, they're there. They exist. And I remember specifically coming to work and Alan Coulter picking out apples at the produce stand right around the corner. He didn't think of himself as famous. And, you know, when people walked up to him, he was almost surprised. He just didn't, it didn't calculate to him, but you know, he was a big part of that show in a lot of ways. And he did Campaign 2000, you know, where like almost every night he was on television, on national television. And then he'd go out and look at an apple and was surprised when people came up to him. You know, he's that kind of guy. He didn't think of people as famous. I don't know what to say about it, but he was just wonderful to me.
Well, it's that lack of ego that you're talking about, you know, and the kindness that that did go through there. You know, and I mean, obviously there's good and bad with everything. The way that I talk about it, and it seems to be to me as I kind of analyze it and talk to people, is that it's a family. And in a family, I mean, I've got a big family on my mother's side. And I mean, there is all sorts of hijinks and things that happen in family, you know, ups and downs with emotions and all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, you're there for each other. You're all trying to do something together, you know, and you know, there's another show tomorrow. We better work well together and find ways to make sure that these gears do interact. And Alan, yeah, certainly has that reputation. Every single person that I've talked to on this show here just seems to have that commonality to them, despite, you know, things that happened. And it's very, very cool to hear that. You were there just after 9/11. I visited New York a couple years after. I think it was in 2003 that I visited New York. And I mean, you still kind of felt like, especially when you go down to Ground Zero, you still feel it. You're there just after. The energy, I mean, you know, patriotism, but at the same time, like eeriness and all of that stuff. While you were there, Tig, did you feel that tension loosen a little bit? And did the New York that you ended up leaving, was it different than the New York that you arrived to?
You know, I was torn because I was having the time of my life. You know, I was working at this show that I had watched as a child with my dad and mom. However, when you left work, it was tough. It was just tough. We'd all seen the images. And, you know, even when I left New York City, there was still, you know, papers on the wall saying, "Have you seen my son? And if you see my son, can you call me?" And then, I mean, I remember going to South Manhattan and there was still this gray material everywhere. When you ate lunch on the awnings, they still hadn't gotten to clean those off. And it was tough because I remember St. Patrick's Day, which would have been a few months into my internship. I went, you know, you're thinking St. Patrick's Day, this is going to be fun. And I went out to a bar. It's the first time I saw a grown man firefighter crying at the bar. It was a tough time. I mean, so no, I think it was too fresh. Even when I left, it was brutal and heartbreaking. And so on the one hand, I am working the greatest internship that I could have dreamed of. However, people are heartbroken out there. So it was a tough time to be there. And yeah, we still felt it. I felt it every day. I think everybody there felt it every day. And it was still a shock even, you know, maybe years later, but, I left, you know, in the mid-year next year after the attacks. And it's still, you remembered that when you went to the airport, you still were looking around, you know? But it, you know, I was lucky to have family around. My sister lived up there. And so that's how I got to do this, 'cause I got to couch it, you know, with her. And, so, you know, I think it was still a pretty tough time. Even at that point, it was still pretty brutal.
I very much appreciate you being vulnerable and talking about that there. And I want to submit something. I'm certain, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that your energy helped them. It helped the Pants family. Bringing in a fresh, you know, you talk about the baseball analogy, bringing in a fresh arm, right? You know, you coming in with that reverence, with the energy that you clearly still have, you know, even in the middle age, you've still got this energy, you know, listening to you, Daniel, you've got this, you know, and you bringing that in, I'm certain helped them. You know, talking to Tommy, where he was, when can we start making fun of President Bush again? You know, and that was the thing where, you know, where it was just, and then there was just one day, like you couldn't do it. And then there's one day where he walked into a wall or something like that. It was benign, had nothing to do with politics whatsoever. And then, you know, the great moments in presidential speeches could continue. You know, it's people don't understand. You know, you talk about the selfie culture that we have now. The digital cameras and things like that didn't exist back then. You couldn't go and get a selfie with Buzz Aldrin. It didn't. It was a different time. And it's weird to me seeing, you know, my youngest, you know, and some of his friends, and they have no idea about this time in North America. We felt it up here in Canada, like that same thing. But when you went to New York, it was amplified so much, and people don't understand that. You were there during that time, and I do appreciate you, you know, kind of opening up about that. When I asked you to be on the show here, one of your responses to me was, you know, first off, of course, self-deprecation. No, I don't know that I, you know, worthy, whatever. But the second thing that, then I asked you the same question that I've asked a few people, did you enjoy your time at Letterman? And your response immediately was, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And that is something that I wanted to get into here, and it just naturally moved into it. So thank you for bringing that energy to the show so they could continue. That show led American, North American entertainment, as far as I'm concerned, through that very, very, very dark time, just like The Tonight Show did during some very hard times during its run as well. And that's also part of your legacy.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the sentiment. And, you know, I think out of deference, a lot of the late night hosts let Dave talk first after 9/11. And because he was going to set the tone. Mr. Leno, I think, waited, the other late night hosts. And, you know, Dave said the same thing. It's like, I don't know. Can we, what does this mean? Are we going to be funny again? Or, you know, and but he made some jokes on that first show back. And then I was actually just looking up some of the shows. And by the third show in, you know, you start to feel a little more comedy. And then the fourth show after that. And but still, there was a sense of let's be careful. People are hurting.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of comedy can we do tonight? Is that too far? And I felt that. And I know that because I used to see the jokes and things before, you know, in the scripts and what would get cut and all that kind of stuff. So it was a wild time. I'm glad that it happened. You know, it was just hard to walk home at night and see those two spotlights. You know, they used to put the towers up with spotlights like that. And, you know, you're having like the greatest day ever. And then you realize, man, people are having the worst day ever, you know. So it was a, you know, weird time, but I'm glad I got to do it. And David Letterman handled it. I don't think anybody could have gotten back on television the way he did and handled it the way he did.
Absolutely.
He did a brilliant job.
The tagline for this, or the mission statement of our show, is we celebrate the greatest body of broadcasting work in history, and that, you know, that's our mission statement, and that is exactly right. He's the greatest broadcaster of all time in good times.
Oh, I think so.
You know, and for Gen Xers, like he is. I've said this too. I've said this all my years growing up. I say this to my dad, and it drives him nuts. David Letterman is my Walter Cronkite. I say that to my dad. He's like, what? And like, it almost like he understands it now. But when I would say that growing up, he didn't understand what it was like to be a Gen Xer, how we needed some of that cynicism. We needed the commentary. We needed the, you know, but at the same time, when something big like this would happen, the leadership as well. And I love when Dave talks about how, you know, about bravery, and it's just as good to pretend that you're brave. Even if you're still feeling fear. And to me, that's leadership. And he shows that. And again, if I ever have the opportunity to talk to him, you know, I'm certain he would downplay it, but it's real. And he did, and does to this day. Like, I mean, I don't know if you're we didn't talk about this beforehand, but I mean, I watched his interview with, he just got nominated for an Emmy. Congratulations to Dave and Tom and the whole crew there. For his interview with President Zelensky.
And yeah, I saw that.
Absolutely. He's Mike Wallace combined with Johnny Carson. Like, he's not Johnny Carson. He's out of the shadow. He's David Letterman. And I'm still to this day so grateful for the output that he is enriching our culture with.
Yeah, David Letterman is one of the biggest broadcasters television has ever created, and really he created himself, but I always thought he was a broadcaster. When I watched Jay Leno, I felt like I was watching a performer that happened to be on television. David, to me, was backwards. He's a broadcaster telling jokes. And I just love that broadcasting sense he had. And it's kind of funny to think the guy who used to put a camera on a monkey would be the guy that get us through 9/11 too, but he did it. You know, that's the kind of broadcaster he is. You know, he's just great. And he inspired my career and I'm forever grateful. And, you know, and there was times in I think a lot of people's lives where things weren't great for them personally, but every night David Letterman was on and it was kind of your, if everything in your life was coming unraveled, the one constant you could count on was that this guy was going to be on TV and he could get you through things. And I know that he probably wouldn't, he probably embarrassed about that, but I really do believe that. Cause I've got buddies, we're all in our 40s now, but they, the same thing when they're 13 years old, a tough time of your life. And then, but boom, there's this constant every night at 11:30 or 10:30, or depending on what, you know, what network he's on, he was there. And that was kind of a, I don't know, source of comfort for me. And plus he was wildly hilarious and, you know, almost he related to me because I was a teenager and he acted like a teenager sometimes, you know, on television. So
when I was great. A child and I saw the early antics on late night before I was able, I would sneak up and watch TV. You know, we had one TV in the house. That was it. It was the old tube TV and I would turn it on and I would be like this far from it because I didn't want my parents to wake up. And the draw of it was, adults are allowed to act this way? Are you kidding me? Like, this is phenomenal. You know, and it feels like you're extending your childhood. It's almost like permission to extend your childhood into those years. The sentiment you talked about, I know Dave understands it because if you think about, if you go back to in 05 when Mr. Carson passed away, Dave's tribute show to him, he talked about that. He talked about how Johnny Carson tucked you in at night every night. And I mean, he may not be able to make the leap that he is Johnny Carson to us, which he is. And I mean, so countless people have said that to him and he just deflects it deftly. But that is the case. I mean, I went through a divorce and like you said, the constant when I was going through that divorce, it's like every night, at least I get to watch Dave and yeah. Some of the stuff that was on, you know, I had the early stage of the DVR, I would keep on from like, if it was a favorite moment, I'd keep it on for months. And I'll tell you this, being able to say thank you to these people is one of the greatest things in my life. You know what? You contributed to that, Ty. You did. You were in the hot pink cat suit. Great. Thank you, buddy. Thank you for being part of that machine while you were there. I want to thank you for that. I want to talk about what happened after that. If you have any other like gem stories that you want to say, we'll finish with that. But I want to talk about when the internship ended and you did get to become a broadcaster. You are a broadcaster. You're on every morning and you've got this popular show. It's you get to do what you love. And I mean, I can feel the gratefulness that you get to do that. It started with Letterman, but what happened after you left and how did your career evolve to where it is today with Daniel?
So what I had to do was go back and finish college. So I checked the box on doing an internship, but I had to return. A lot of people, their internship is the last thing. I did it out of order somehow. I don't know. And so I went back to Auburn University and I finished up my degree. And I was this close to just moving back home with my parents because I didn't have anything, but I got offered a job in radio. Yep. And so I said, oh, that sounds pretty good to me. And yeah. And from there, it just kind of grew. And
Were you on air right away?
Yeah. No, I sucked, but I was in a small town. So you get what you get in a small town. And, you know, you learn and you go.
But it grows and you get better, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a trial by fire and you listen to your air checks and then you go, boy, that sucked. And then you try to get better and better and better. And then you know, I had a buddy, Daniel, my buddy, Daniel, intern at MTV in New York. However, we didn't know each other, but we both had that commonality and we're best buds. And it's great to have a career with your best friend. And from there, we just kind of grew. It's kind of like baseball. You want to get to bigger and bigger, bigger markets.
Yeah.
You know, you might play AA and then you get to AAA and then you get to Atlanta or New York. And so we've had a great career. When we were in Nashville, we were on a bunch of stations across the nation. And then during the pandemic, that kind of went away for us. And so now we're in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which I didn't even know where that was on a map until I got here.
Yep.
But, you know, it's been great. They pay me every 2 weeks and I have probably David Letterman to thank for the inspiration. And I've got a great career.
Yeah, well, you can tell the fun that you two are having. You can't fake that. And I would just throw out to our audience as well. Hey, look, they're on. You don't have to be in Tulsa to listen to the Tig and Daniel show. You can listen to it on Apple and Spotify. Is there other platforms? Are there?
I just say I don't know the answer. I just say I know it's on Apple, Spotify, and then pretty much just wherever you listen to podcasts, just Google it. And if it doesn't show up, you know, go about your day and live your life. But if you
that's
see
exactly
it, maybe
what I say about this show. That's exactly what I say. I know we're on the Apples and the Spotifys, and I think other places too, but
it's somewhere out there. Yeah.
But for people who are out there, if you want to, you know, if you're looking for some content, you don't know, go to the show and listen to it. It is really, really, really good. There's the music's not in there. It's just the banter back and forth between Tig and Daniel. And it's so natural and fun. And just, it's a really, really, it's just a fun show. And I really love how you guys get to do this. And you get paid every 2 weeks to do that, which, again, doesn't seem legal when you love doing
ridiculous.
Something like that so much, does it?
It's ridiculous. And we're very blessed. And I think the Letterman show, just having that line on my resume, at least got people's attention. And I think it's helped us out a lot. And it's at least a conversation starter, whereas a lot of resumes come in and, you know, they just kind of fall by the wayside. I think the David Letterman show helped us along just to at least get a call back, you know, and that's been great for us. And I appreciate the people that are so kind to us in New York, Mr. Letterman, who I only had a couple run-ins with, but I appreciate him too. It was great.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, this is a love letter to, that's what the show is. It's a love letter to what everybody at Pantsland has done. And you certainly feel that way. The echoes are reverberating very, very well. I'm going to put out one more thing before we shut the recorder off. What part of this conversation started by you are lightening some of the physical load that you have of items and things, and you were giving away a couple of scripts and things that you had. And I reached out to you and I put my hand up and said, hey, I would love, you know, we've got some scripts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've got some scripts personally. I'd love to give one or two away. And then you said to me, oh, well, Letterman podcast, would you like a cue card? And I was like, oh yes, please. I would very much like a cue card. That'd be awesome. I just want to publicly thank you for that.
You'll really get it. But I started thinking about, I did collect some memorabilia from the show. I didn't steal anything, but every night they would send out a script to the whole staff, even interns. And, you know, I thought this is like very special, but the people that worked there, they had seen those for 2000 shows. So it was like not as important to them, but I started collecting them. And the cue card that I'm going to send you is, I started thinking about, how did I come across this cue card? Well, Tony Mendez gave it to me, but the reason I have it is it's a joke that got cut from the show.
Really?
Yes.
Oh,
so,
I like that.
Yeah. So Bill Schiff and Dave or whoever got together and they would go through and Dave's like, I don't think about that one. And I think that's why it got put to the side and why Tony gave it to me.
Oh,
so
great.
I think it's a cut joke. If that, I hope that doesn't affect you that much, but I think it's a cut joke.
Are you kidding me? That's like, no, I'm that guy. Like, I am a music guy. And if somebody sends me a B-side or a rarity, a live performance of something that, no, that to me is like, that's
all right. Well,
you got
a cut joke coming to you on a cue card. And, but Tony, I think you saw Tony had written me a nice note during my internship, Tony Mendez. And so that's, and he would give me cue cards every now and then. And I think that the few I got were probably cut. Maybe one of them made it. I don't know. I can't remember. We could watch the archives to find out, I guess.
Could not appreciate it more. Thank you so much. Tig Rogers, 98.5 The Bull, the Tig and Daniel show every day, every weekday. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy, busy schedule. I know your radio guys get pulled everywhere and you guys have to go appearances and all that kind of stuff. I know you've just finished the show as well. You start early in the morning. Thank you so much, Tig, for taking time out of your day to share some of these experiences on the Letterman podcast. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
No, it's fun to listen to you. I knew you before you reached out because you have these people on that they won't remember who I am, but you know, when you have the folks on that I worked with, it kind of is nostalgic for me. And I had on road trips and things, I would listen to the podcast. And so I actually knew the podcast and I think people know about the podcast. So when you asked me to come on, I said, you're going to be wasting your time, brother. But you said, no, come on, let's do it. So,
so and yet I think that the previous hour or so has gone quite to the contrary. Thank you, man. I appreciate this so much. I'll shoot a separate outro for this. Tig Rogers, everybody. Thank you so much for taking time, buddy. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. How much fun was that? Tig is just a great guy, and I just appreciate him so, so much for taking of his time. You know, those morning guys, those morning radio guys, I mean, they put in a lot of time and effort. And so he had finished a show, and that's when he, you know, took some time to come on here and tell the stories that he did. I'm just so grateful for that. So great. When the cue card arrives here, we will certainly put it up and show it to everybody. I'll even attempt. I'm terrible at jokes. I'm not a joke, as you're all probably like, yeah, Mike, you're not funny at all. I do have moments of being funny, but mostly it's like quips and things like that, like comebacks. I can do that. I don't understand the mechanics of a joke very well. I just don't. And that's something that might be able to be learned, or maybe it's something that just escapes, you know, my ability. I'm not certain which, but when the cue card does arrive, I'm going to do my best to figure out a way to tell the joke. Especially it was a cut joke anyway. So, I don't think I'm stepping on anybody by trying to do that. I'm going to try and figure out a way to tell the joke when it gets here, but I just so grateful for Tig, being willing to do that, to part with a cue card imparted to him by Tony Mendez. So we just got to say thank you for that. Yeah, go to hello-deli.com if you want any Late Show with David Letterman merchandise. Get it while you can. Not sure what's going to happen moving forward. Hopefully, Rupert will still be able to do that part and still be connected to the Letterman world that way. But we're not sure. I'm not sure what's going on. We'll ask him that question when he talks about what it is that is happening next. This has been another episode of the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm. Coincidentally, I am Mike Chisholm. Thank you and good night.
Overcoat and underpants.